The Vox Markets Podcast with Justin Waite. Nothing in this podcast is intended as investment advice, and the people in this podcast may hold positions in the stocks they talk about. Do not buy anything based solely on a tip or recommendation. Please do your own research.
Welcome to the podcast on Wednesday, the 16th of January, 2019. On the podcast today, I have Sachin Oza, Co-Chief Executive Officer of Rehoboam Resources. And Sachin discusses the results from the Wick drill and progress at their other investments. Plus, I have Ian Smith, Chief Executive Officer of 1PM Group, OPM. And Ian talks through the highlights from the interim results and also discusses the outlook. Plus, Aidan Bishop, founder of Big Dish, that's D-I-S-H, talks about their launch in Bournemouth and the completion of the Big Dish app beta testing period. I also have on John Mayer, mining analyst and partner at SP Angel, talking about Anglo-Asian Mining, AAZ, Keras Resources, KRS, and Strategic Minerals. Plus, I have two lists for you, as always, the top five most followed companies on Vox Market in the last 24 hours, and the top five most liked RNSs too. By the way, you can see top 10 versions of these lists at voxmarket.co.uk.
Want to get live push notification alerts whenever a company you follow releases an RNS? Find out more at voxmarkets.co.uk/app.
And joining me on the podcast right now is Sachin Oza, Co-Chief Executive Officer of Rehoboam Resources, RBD. Sachin, thanks for joining me on the podcast.
Thank you very much for having me, Justin.
Now, news out today, not the most welcome news or wanted news, but you know, it happens. But you know, you have a portfolio of investments, and we'll go through those as well, what's happening next. But before we do, as always, it's probably best for you to summarise. For someone listening right now, tell us about Rehoboam, what you're all about. Summarise it, please, Sachin.
Yeah, so when I first started coming on to Vox to give an idea of what Rehoboam's about, we always start off with the same points, which is Rehoboam Resources provides capital to low technical risk upstream oil and gas projects, such that that capital we provide leads to near-term drilling, and in success, the assets and projects that we fund can be monetized quickly, and each of the projects will be transformational to the company. And I always used to talk about that in the future tense. It is worth highlighting, since we started only a short period ago within oil and gas terms, a little over a year, we have actually had a successful program of workovers and two new wells in California, which are in production and generating cash flow. So I should probably summarize by saying we have done and will continue to drill low technical risk opportunities with quick pathways to monetization, each of which will be transformational to the company.
Yeah, yeah. Well, let's just go through the results. We just had the news from Corallian today about Wick. So take us through what we know there, if you could.
Yeah, so it's worthwhile highlighting that Wick was a well in the Inner Moray Firth that Corallian, as you said, was the operator of. But Corallian was substantially carried for that well. And it was really an exploration, much more an exploration well. That project entered our portfolio because when we made the investment in Corallian Energy, primarily funding the Coulter well, we effectively, if you like, got a free shot at Wick, in inverted commas. And that meant that it was a sensible project within our portfolio in that context. But what it doesn't fit, it does not fit the low technical risk aspect that we will typically look for our projects. Unfortunately, it was a dry well. It's being plugged and abandoned, but we look forward with great excitement to the campaign ahead of us, both in the UK within the Corallian investment, but across the rest of our projects as well.
Yeah, and like I say, is it worth pointing out that Wick was an exploration well, and exploration wells, you know, the chance of success are odds against generally, aren't they? I mean, you know, it can go anything from high impact, which can be 1 in 10 almost, but this was around about 30%, so less than a 1 in 3 chance, so people have to put this into context, you know, so every time, 3 times you drill, you'd only be successful once, whereas Coulter is, like I say, is an appraisal, it's 58% chance. So odds on. It's less of a gamble. It's more chance of success there, isn't there?
Yes, and you know the numbers you quoted are reasonably accurate. I think there's probably some deviation, a little bit, between the operators and joint venture partners that talk about the assets. But you're absolutely right in principle in terms of how you've described them, Justin. And it's not helpful to go through this, you know, from a shareholder point of view, because when you look at those risks, it's made up of a number of factors. And what you're trying to do is you're really trying to isolate the risks into buckets that you can really deal with as an oil and gas company. So, for instance, in WIC, yes, there was a high chance, there was a lower chance of success, primarily because of trapping of oil and gas. So we found the oil bearing, the sands and reservoir as expected. They were very good quality, again, as expected, but we didn't trap the oil in the structure that had been identified. And that was the key risk factor that failed in that case. As I say, I know that that is not a helpful thing because it just, it didn't work. But when we're looking at risk factors, that's how we at Rehobald kind of try to identify them. When we look at the appraisal opportunities, the risk parameters that we deal with are much more constrained and therefore give us greater comfort of chances of success, both in terms of commercial and monetization, after just the simple technical success of drilling the well.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely. So just touching on other things, other bits of news people can expect now from Rehobald, where are they, Sachin?
Yeah, so just focusing on the Ensco 72 jackup rig, which will plug and abandon WIC, that then moves on to Coulter. We've talked about Coulter already. This is adjacent to the very prolific Witch Farm producing field in the south of England, and that's a very exciting opportunity. But in the near term, we also have a well going down in California that will go down in California in February, we expect, which is on the Monroe Swell license area. We also have ahead of us the Parta license drilling in Romania and West Newton onshore UK. All of those will be happening in the next few months, and each will be transformational to the company. Again, just to stress, these are much more appraisal type opportunities and appraisal stroke development type opportunities, and we're very excited by the upside they will present to our investors.
Yeah, absolutely. One final thing then, Sachin, as always, if someone is listening to this right now and likes the sound of what you're doing but are not yet following the story, give them those three quick reasons why they should hit that follow button and add you to their watch list, please.
Certainly, Justin. So we'll just summarize very quickly everything that's been said so far. The first thing is that Rehobald has demonstrated success already in the strategy that it's deploying. And we also accelerated the cash flows from the successful wells to demonstrate the ability to monetize successful drilling in California. So that's the one thing, that we do have the success behind us already. Our intention, though, is to build on that success with similar looking projects which are coming up in terms of drilling in the next few weeks and months ahead of us. We feel that each of those will be transformational to the company and present significant upside to our investors. But beyond that, we also have a set of projects for new investments that we can make and projects within the existing portfolio of companies that we have already invested in. And we look forward to maturing those and in time presenting our investors with the running room beyond just these near-term high-impact, exciting opportunities that we have.
Marvellous stuff. Sachin, it was good to chat to you, and hopefully we'll be catching up again in the not-too-distant future. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much.
The Vox Markets Podcast with Justin Waite.
And joining me on the podcast right now is Ian Smith, Chief Executive Officer of 1PM, that's OPM ticker. Ian, thanks for joining me.
Good to speak to you again, Justin.
Yeah, and you've some decent figures out. So your interim results for the 6 months ended the 30th of November 2018 are out, and strong trading momentum from continued organic growth, record half-year deal origination revenues and profits, and first interim dividend declared. So, and I've looked through some of the figures, a lot of double-digit percentage growth there, so we'll go into that in a bit. Before we do, Ian, for people not familiar with 1PM, can you explain what you're about, please?
Yeah, sure. So we're a moneylender. We're not a bank. We've deliberately taken a policy not to be a bank. So we're a specialist finance provider. We operate Unusually, we operate a hybrid model. So we're both a funder and a broker. So we lend on our own balance sheet at our own risk, but we also pass deals on to other lenders. And what we concentrate on in terms of our own lending is finance for UK SMEs, and particularly the smaller companies in the UK SME scale who meet our credit criteria. And we also arrange consumer finance in terms of property and vehicle finance, but we broke that all on to other lenders. So our own balance sheet lending is all to UK business. And we've deliberately set our stall out to be a provider of the main finance products that small business require. So that's asset finance for their plant and machinery, vehicle finance for their vans or fleets of cars, invoice finance, so lending to companies against their receivables, and also loans, and positioning ourselves deliberately to be a multi-product provider of finance to UK SMEs is one of the reasons that I think underpins some very good numbers.
Yeah, and I've seen that both parts of the business are growing, but lending on your own book is the bigger part of the business at the moment, isn't it?
Yes, it is. So we originated just over £82 million worth of new finance deals in the 6 months to 30th of November, to the half year. Typically, around 60% of those deals will be broked on to other lenders. But when you add up all the lending on our own balance sheet, we now have receivables of £142 million. Mm-hmm. And in terms of revenue, the way that splits out is that interest income and other income from that balance sheet lending is about 80% of our revenue, yeah. And about 20% is broked on transactions. So of the 16 million of revenue in the half year, which was a 15% increase on this time last year, of that 16 million, about 80% comes from interest from our own book lending. So that is the larger proportion of the business, correct?
Yeah. Okay. So before we get into the figures here, just if someone's thinking as an investor, okay, so why would a business, a small or medium-sized enterprise, choose you rather than a bank? What's the difference there?
Well, there are something like 5.5 million SMEs in the UK. 30% of those are permanent non-borrowers. Of those that want to raise finance, only a very small percentage, less than 10%, actually secure funding from their banks. And the reason they come to specialist and alternative finance providers like ourselves is that we can essentially provide them with a solution very quickly. For example, when our brokers bring opportunities to us for financing small business, we promise them a turnaround of 4 hours in terms of an initial decision as to whether we can provide that funding or not. So it's about speed of service. It's then about follow-up of service to ensure we deliver that funding on a timely basis and follow through with what we promised to deliver. And for these small businesses, they're making decisions where they want business critical equipment and they want it straight away in order to be able to run and expand their business. So it's about providing a tailored service and a very rapid service and giving them a clear answer as soon as they have a requirement.
Yeah, absolutely. Okay, well, take us through some of the highlights from the interims, if you could, Ian.
Yes, certainly. So as I mentioned, 82 million of business origination for the 6 months, which was an increase of 10% over the previous year. I mentioned revenue being 16 million, which is a record for us for the half year period. Again, a significant increase. Our operating profit, and that's profit before exceptional costs in the profit and loss account, is 4.1 million. That's an increase of 14% over the same period last year. And what all that translates into is an earnings per share increase, which clearly our shareholders are most interested in, an increase of 12% to 3.62 pence. So again, that's a record earnings per share for a 6 months period.
Yeah.
All of that is backed up by a strong balance sheet. We have net assets of over 50 million now, 51 million at 30th of November. And we're well provided. We have provisions in our balance sheet against potential impairments of receivables that are run at about 2% of our lending portfolio, whereas we're actually only experiencing write-offs of around 1% of our portfolio. So I feel we're very well protected for any potential impairment of our receivables if economic conditions worsen going forward. Yeah. So I think, you know, strong balance sheet and a good performance in terms of revenue and profits.
Absolutely. Well, do you know what? Looking at these results, you wouldn't think we are in the middle of economic uncertainty which has been afforded us by Brexit and all this worries and people putting investment decisions off because that's what happens with uncertainty. It looks like business is strong, but I mean, going forward, what's the outlook like here?
Well, firstly, on the point about business being strong, one of the reasons is, and it's an important reason, is the type of business that we're lending to. As I mentioned, they tend to be the smaller end of the SME scale. They tend to be sort of owner-managed, owner-operated businesses that have a very high degree of resilience against the economic cycle. So, for example, and just an example off the top of my head, if you've got a MOT garage in the village that's been there for 30 years, it's probably going to be there for another 30 years. And if the proprietor of that business wants a new MOT bay, he's going to make a decision to fund that MOT bay because that's what his business is all about. In some ways, he's completely unconcerned, in one sense, about what's happening at the sort of the macroeconomic scale or the political scale. So a lot of the small businesses we lend to are carrying on, delivering their business and not delaying investment decisions. Now, clearly, that's not the case with some bigger companies in the SME scale. There are some businesses that, of course, are putting off or delaying decisions. And that is a concern. In terms of the future, to answer the second part of your question, I think I have already gone on record as saying that the Brexit uncertainties that we have right now are both an opportunity and a threat. You know, for some companies, they will have some cash flow difficulties as we progress through the next months, whatever happens with Brexit. And I think we stand ready to be able to help those companies with their cash requirements. But equally, some companies will struggle and suffer. And that's where we think we're doing the right thing by having a bad debt provision that's bigger than the actual level of write-offs that we've experienced historically.
Yeah. So confident going forward and yeah, and obviously prepared for that. And like you say, you know what, it's true, actually. When you see small businesses like that, and you know, they are sort of quite prudent. They know about their cash flow. They know how customers operate. And so I suppose, you know, that kind of thing is quite stable, isn't it, in that way? And like I say, you're providing for that anyway. Excellent stuff, yeah. And you're confident then. I mean, even with Brexit and even with this uncertainty, and I think a lot of it is basically is fear of the unknown. When a decision gets made, I think people will start investing again. But you are pretty confident, are you?
I think we're confident because we're in the right position, both in terms of having this range of products that we're able to provide for businesses that are pretty resilient. We're providing finance to companies that produce a staple diet products and services. So we all go and get our cars MOT'd, we all go and get our haircut, we all go and get our sandwiches and our coffee, and those are the kind of the small businesses that we provide finance for. So, yeah, we are confident that we won't see some of the worst effects that could happen as a result of Brexit, and I think we're pretty optimistic and be able to continue to see the organic growth that we've delivered over the last 6-12 months.
Yeah, and I'm just looking at you. So you are valued at the moment around about 40 million market cap. And your net assets are above that, which is also, if people are looking at value investing, that's a good metric, isn't it, there?
Yeah, I think there are a couple of commentators and analysts who find our valuation on the stock market a bit anomalous, given the results that we're delivering. And that's obviously what we're trying to do, is to correct that by continuing to deliver the numbers that we can. I mean, that's what we can control, and certainly that's what we're aiming to achieve. If we continue to deliver steady figures, steady numbers with a resilient business, then hopefully the valuation will gradually improve and come through.
Yeah, okay. Well, one final thing, Ian. If someone's listening to this, likes the sound of the progress you're making but are not following the story, please give them three quick reasons why they should hit that follow button on your page on Vox and add you to their watch list, please.
Well, first reason is that we are multi-product. I think that's exactly the right place to be for small businesses. They just need cash to run their businesses. So if we can provide the different types of financing product they require, then we're in a good place. Secondly, I've mentioned resilience. We are a business that's providing funding to a resilient sector of the UK economy. So irrespective of current uncertainties, I think we can look forward with optimism for the future. And then thirdly, unearned income. We have £142 million worth of receivables on our balance sheet. One or two will clearly go wrong, but the vast majority will perform. And that means we've got something in the order of £20 million of unearned interest that's going to come through and will form part of our revenue and our profits going forward. So we already have good visibility on our earnings going forward.
Marvellous stuff. Good to chat to you, Ian. And hopefully we'll be catching up again in not too distant future. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Justin. Pleasure to speak again soon.
The Vox Markets Podcast with Justin Waite.
And joining me on the podcast right now is Aidan Bishop, founder of Big Dish. D-I-S-H, Dish is the ticker there. Easy to remember. Aidan, thanks for coming on.
Hey, Justin. Thank you very much.
Now, before we get into the news that you're launching in Bournemouth, tell us what it is. What is Big Dish? What's it all about, please, Aidan?
Big Dish is a yield management platform for restaurants. So what we do is we enable our users to be able to get great deals at primarily at off-peak times at some great restaurants. And it works on the premise of yield management, which is sort of a dynamic pricing strategy, which basically means charging different prices at different times for the same product. So what we're finding is that restaurants are like to give the higher discounts at some of the off-peak times. So for example, maybe just at the beginning of the evening meal time, or right at the end of it, that type of thing. And we enable our users to get some great deals, up to 50% off on mostly on the food. Some restaurants have beverage as well, but most do not. And for your entire dining party.
Yeah, and at the moment, is there anything else like this out there in the UK market, an app like this?
In the UK, there are a number of different discount type of programs, most sort of kind of old-fashioned, which are like around discount cards or vouchers or coupons or some derivative of that. So we are starting to see a sort of a move towards using tech to do sort of smarter discounts. I mean, one of the hashtags we have is Dine Smarter, and that's sort of what we're really all about, Dine Smarter from the consumer perspective, but also from the restaurant perspective, because of course an empty table makes no money in a restaurant. So every time a table is filled, bums on seats, the restaurant makes money and consumers are happy.
Yeah, absolutely. And okay, so at the moment, you've just launched in Bournemouth. So take us through the detail here, if you could, Aidan.
Right. Well, when we IPO'd last year, we acquired a company called Table Pouncer that had a yield management platform in Bournemouth. And what we did was that we went into a beta testing period in September, which we announced. It went on a bit longer than we thought. I guess in hindsight, sometimes with tech, it's never good to give precise timelines, because you invariably don't hit them, and we basically didn't. But the good thing about it was it allowed us to really get insights into user experiences, restaurant experiences, and really prepared for us to come into the UK market. So in the last few months, we've spent a lot of time listening to restaurants, talking to restaurants, listening to some users. We had a few restaurants that were live in Bath, and we started to learn from those experiences. And we spent a lot of time upgrading the app, making the app more UK-centric. So we've changed the logo. Our logo before was more suited towards an Asian type of market. The new logo is really more for the UK market. And, you know, we've changed some of the graphics and features and just made it more focused towards the UK, which is going to be the big market for us this year. So what we've announced today is migration of the Table Pouncer restaurants onto the Big Dish platform. So, and we've also increased the deal quality as well. So there's over 50 restaurants right now today in Bournemouth, for example, where you can get 50% off today. So that's what we've been busy doing, and that's what today's announcement is all about. And we're quite excited for 2019, because we worked hard on getting the platform to be ready for the UK market. And now that it is, you're going to see, as we announced today, upgrades to the website over the next 4 to 6 weeks. And really, we're going to start to see an accelerated rollout throughout the current territories that we're in. And we'll be updating the market shortly on this, and also on the wider UK rollout. So that is the goal and ambition, is to be all over the UK.
Yeah, and it is one of those things. To me, it's like a no-brainer. You know, I've said this before to you, and I quite like the concept, yeah. Because for a consumer, for the person who's going out and dining, it's why wouldn't I check the app just to see if I can get a deal, you know, just in case. And
it's a no-brainer. You're right, Justin. I mean, look, when people travel, or what do? They go to like Trivago, for example, right? Mm-hmm. And they look for deals and what's there. It's very similar in a way that, you know, if you're going out to eat, why would you not want to, you know, see what deals are available? And what yield management is all about is about altering consumer behavior. And so, you know, the airline industry started with this, the hotel industry as well. And we're seeing it happening as well. well in the restaurant industry, that people are, you know, are choosing to, you know, dine maybe slightly earlier or slightly later, or on an evening they wouldn't normally dine out on. They're getting to experience new restaurants and they're getting great value.
Yeah. So how do you market yourself then? How do people find out about Big Dish?
There's a number of ways that can be done. We search engine optimization. There's sort of app store optimization. Mm-hmm. There's Facebook, social media predominantly, Google, email marketing, just a number of different ways, all digital marketing, really.
Yeah. So you're at Bournemouth, Bristol, and then, and what's
we're
next?
Not in Bristol yet.
No.
We're not in Bristol just yet. We announced that we're going to be going to Bristol at the end of this month. We have been signing up restaurants in Bristol already, so we're not going into Bristol cold. We expect Bristol to go live, as we announced today, by the end of this month. We're in Bath and we're in Bournemouth, and so we expect the number of restaurants to increase in Bournemouth, and we also see that how we'll start to update the market in due course on the shape of the current territories we've got. And by the shape of it, I mean what towns we're targeting, what cities we're targeting, what demographic we're targeting, and that way the market will get an idea of how we define our territories, what they are, and we'll start to get a feel for how we're going to roll out across the UK this year.
Yeah, and so you are targeting other cities, not necessarily beginning with B, is that right?
That is true.
Birmingham could be there. Birmingham's a big one there.
There you go. In fact, we're also, I don't know how far Paul away is. Paul is from Bournemouth. I think it's just around the corner.
Yeah.
I was just checking the app out now. There's a steakhouse there that's available today, so which looks quite nice. So we are not just in, we are going to be in other towns and cities around these other places like Bournemouth and so forth.
I'm not far from Bournemouth, you know. I'm literally, 40 minutes drive, so less than that, 35, so I could give it a try. I got the app. I'm going to have a look at it. So
quite good. Look, I would imagine we'd be coming to your area. That will certainly be covered in one of the territories pretty soon, I would imagine.
Yeah, exciting times. Marvellous stuff. Okay, with Aidan, last thing, just for... to finally convince people, if they haven't got you on their watch list as yet, give them three quick reasons why they should hit that follow button on your page and add you to their watch list, please.
Well, I think we're going to be in for a great year. So the tech is ready now. It took a bit longer than we had hoped, but it's ready to go now. So I would be expecting that we'd have a quite accelerated rollout around the UK this year. So I would expect from that as well that it will generate lots and lots of news flow. So we're hoping to be a very good, a news flow friendly company this year going into 2019. And that should please our shareholders. But ultimately, as you said, it's a no-brainer, yield management. It's quite easy to understand, and easy concepts tend to do very well. So let's see how Big Dish does this year.
Marvellous stuff, Aidan. Good to chat to you. And like I say, a news flow coming. This year should be quite strong, quite full on. So hopefully we'll be chatting again in the not too distant future. Thanks very much.
Great. Cheers. Thank you.
The Vox Markets Podcast with Justin Waite.
And joining me on the podcast right now is John Mayer, mining analyst and partner at SP Angel. You're right, John.
Yes, very good. Thank you. Happy New Year to you.
Yes. Do you know what? I can tell people who are really making a success of their lives, because these are the people who are regular on the podcast, I don't get to talk to, gone midway through January, and they're still sort of partying it up, you know? And you're one of those guys, John, still partying until, what, the 16th? Or when did you come back?
I was back last week, so but very happy to be back in the comfort of global markets and the mining sector.
Yeah, you've got life sussed, I think, John, or close to getting it. Would you say that, I mean, is there such a thing as that, getting life sussed? I mean, you're doing a job you really enjoy, aren't you? And you've got a passion for it, I suppose. But would you say you got life sussed?
Well, I like what I do. I have
that's
a passion
key,
for small companies, and I love these miners, and I particularly love them when they do well. Mm-hmm. And many of these, the little companies that we work with, seem to do very well. So so that's good. I mean, it's not good when they go down. And there are some that take longer to succeed than others, but most of them get there in the end, and that feels really good.
Yeah. Well, do you know what? It's that old cliche, which rings true, isn't it? If you love the job you're doing, you don't work a day in your life, and that's a good thing. But it can be the flip side. Like me, I love this. You know, I love to talk about stocks and shares. I started on the radio. In fact, I started getting obsessed with stocks and shares. Then I had an idea of going to the city, but I didn't. Then I got the radio bug, and now I sort of combine it, and I do a podcast on stocks and shares. But like you said, what happens is you get too passionate. Now, it happens to me a lot, and I'm just chatting to you about it. Sometimes I wake up in the middle of the night to go to the toilet or something, and then I'll think about something that I read in an RNS or something like that. You know, hang on, did I read that correctly? And I get obsessed with it, and I can't go back to sleep. So this morning I got up at, you know, 3:30, but I woke up at 2, but I got up at 3, and then just had to read something in an RNS. And so it's a fine line between enjoying it but not being obsessed. I think I'm towards the obsessed end, you know, which is not good. But anyway, John, let's get some news on stocks that you're looking at. So I know you had 3 stocks there, but let's go alphabetical. What's the first one, John?
Well, Anglo-Asian Mining, our analyst Sergey here, he put up his target price valuation to £1.08 yesterday. Share price was at 84. And that company goes from strength to strength. They produced 83,700 ounces of gold last year. That's 17% up on the year before. And they go from strength to strength. They look good. They're paying dividends. $27.5 million in free cash flow in the year. Now those are nice numbers, and we've worked with this company for many years. They've had their ups and downs, but they really got it together. It's working very well. Yes, they're in Azerbaijan, which is not necessarily the world's most favored holiday destination, but actually it's a beautiful place, and it's well worth a visit to Anglo Asian's operations. It's a very professional thing.
Yeah, AAZ, and I'm looking for. Yeah, I'm looking at gold stocks at the moment. I just think, I know, towards the end of next year, I think gold will come into its own. If you look at the gold chart, it's look at a long distance, a long sort of long time frame. It had a rally up through $1,000, went up to 1,800, and it's come back and consolidating now. You know, and I think it may spend a while consolidating, but I do believe gold will go higher. You know, in the next couple of years.
What's going on in the States with the shutdown and the potential for Trump to create chaos in the world, I mean, I don't think he will, but maybe I'm hopeful. So I think more people are going to come back into gold. There was a lot of money that went into Bitcoin, and a lot of profits made on Bitcoin as well. And that definitely hit the gold price. And also quite a lot of money that's been going into marijuana in Canada. Again, I think that's been negative for gold. And I think the money's going to come back, because at the end of the day, gold is a good place to store money when times look tough.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, I'm just looking now, going back to 2011, went up to sort of $1,900 maybe, nearly, and did a double top at $1,800 and came all the way back down. It's found it hard to break through that almost $1,350 level, you know, $1,360. It's now at $1,290, pretty much. So,
Remember that it's going to be difficult for the Americans to keep raising interest rates, which the raises they've done have caused money to flow back into the United States, along with tax cuts and all of that. It can't carry on forever. And if the US economy dips down a bit and the Chinese economy also softens a little bit from where we are, then all the more reason for policymakers to be helpful, as we see today in China with tax cuts that are going to sure to add, I think it's about another $300 billion to their economy, which equates to something over 1% of potential GDP boost. These are positive things for the world, but they're being put in place because there are some negative headwinds out there, and again those negative headwinds are seen as risky and good for gold.
Yeah, do you know what? The run was the big run, wasn't it? From almost like the year 2000, where it was at $250, $260 an ounce. And then we went up from then, the next 10 years. Look at that, it went up to $1,800, $1,900. That was a nice upside, wasn't it?
Remember that $250 an ounce mark, known as the brown bottom in the trade, when Gordon Brown decided to sell a lot of the UK's
I know.
Gold
sick.
Reserves. And so we the UK created that low level, and prices have sort of been going up ever since, although we hit a peak and came back. Like a lot of things, it overshot. I think the gold price has consolidated well, and it's likely to move forwards again from here.
Yeah, absolutely. Joe, I'm going to take a screenshot of this and I'll put it on Twitter and say, and take the price out and the name out and say, what chart is this? There we are, a little quiz. Don't cheat, John, okay? So that's AAZ, Anglo-Asian. Okay, alphabetically, what's next, John?
Carash Resources, another one of our clients. Mm-hmm. They report this morning that they've been producing 41% manganese in Togo. They've done a trial, 10,000 ton bulk sample, which they sent to their off-taker, which is a manganese alloy producer. They won't name the producer, but clearly it's somebody important in the manganese trade. What this means is that they're going to get more money for their manganese, because we were assuming that they'd get about 35% manganese within the ore, and 42% manganese is going to attract a nice premium. They've got all the kit in place to do 6,500 tons a month, so that can start to produce some sensible numbers and certainly underpins our valuation. We put a certain amount of we always put in risk factors on these things, and I can see Keras having a good run actually. I can see that as a stock that could really go places this year.
Mm-hmm. KRS ticker there. They've been on the podcast quite a lot, so hopefully we'll get them on. What's their market cap, KRS? It's about sub 10, isn't it? Sub 10 million? Yeah, it's about 8.6 million. What's next then, John?
Strategic Minerals, another one of our investment clients. They report that they've sold 11,000 tons of magnetite from their Cobre operations in New Mexico in the United States. That sells quite well. That sells for $633,000, and it brings their total revenues there to $3.3 million for the year, and that helps to fund the other things that they're doing, which frankly are more exciting than the magnetite. Mm-hmm. So they are funding tin and tungsten exploration drilling in Cornwall at the Redmore mine. I went to look at that at the end of last year. Pretty impressed actually by the grades of the tin and the tungsten coming out of that, and so then in my view they should definitely, you know, go much more aggressively at the drilling of that project, because it looks like that could become a new tin tungsten mine over time. I would prefer it to be a tin mine rather than a tungsten mine, but it could be both.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And then I think that the more important thing on their own radar is the Lee Creek copper operations in Australia, which they're planning to get up and running in the next couple of years. Could be quite quickly, really. And that's the reprocessing of copper tailings dumps. And that looks nice, and it looks relatively small. But there's a lot of potential to expand that operation going forwards in Australia. So I think they're in the right place at the right time.
Yeah, okay. SML, the guys often come on the podcast too, and all got skin in the game, and, honest, transparent operators, always happy to take questions. It's very good. So hopefully we get them on again soon. John, thanks for that, fella, and we'll speak next week, hopefully.
Very welcome. Look forward to it. Thank you.
Okay, it's time for the top five most followed companies on Vox Markets in the last 24 hours. They are at five. Rehoboll Resources. Just spoke to Sachin on the podcast, of course. RBD. At four, Anglo-African Oil & Gas, AAOG. At three, Ectech. That's EQT. At two, Itaconics, ITX. And number one most followed company was Red Emperor Resources, RMP, is the ticker there. Okay, now it's time for the top five most liked RNSs. At five, Rockrose Energy, TR1 notification of major interest, major holdings. At four, Alba Mineral Resources, Horsell update. At three, Encondesi Energy, issue of equity. At two, Strategic Minerals, Q4 Cobre magnetite sales and cash balance update. Of course, John just covered those in the podcast. And number one most liked RNS came from UK Oil & Gas. Kimmeridge Oil Production continues at HH1 or Horse Hill 1. That's it for the podcast. Thanks for listening. Muchos apreciados.
The Vox Markets Podcast with Justin Waite. Nothing in this podcast is intended as investment advice, and the people in this podcast may hold positions in the stocks they talk about. Do not buy anything based solely on a tip or recommendation. Please do your own research.